John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Tony Martin here is my co-host on The Conversation Hour. Morning to you, Tony.
Good morning, John. Good morning, listeners.
Are you one of the funniest men alive?
No. I'm probably one of the funniest people with the name Tony Martin, because the other rivals, of course, are the German cyclist, the seventh lead singer of Black Sabbath, and the bloke who was Nettie Smith on Blue Murder. And, of course, the one who was married to the late Sid Charisse. There's a lot of us.
I don't have that problem.
No, are there no other John Faynes?
There probably are, but I've never bothered to find them. But it's not something that troubles me particularly.
Oh, I left out the bloke who shot two people who burst into his farmhouse in England and is now a figurehead for being allowed to kill people who break into your house.
Was that a Tony Martin?
Yeah, so like the name Tony Martin in England, right. We went over to England to
and
shoot.
And they went, what, he's doing stand-up
no,
now?
No, that's right, because it's like Pauline Hanson. It's like a notorious name. It's like having the name Ferdinand Marcos and going, I'm here to make a comedy show.
There's an idea.
Yeah.
Sure. It'll take off, I tell you what. Hey, the comedy festival getting underway, and I don't know, have you heard the buzz?
What is the buzz?
There are, how do you describe it, secret shows.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of a couple of secret shows.
But there are people performing who are not on the program.
Right.
There's no marketing.
Yeah.
No mention of it. You just have to be in the know.
I see. Because last year, Patton Oswalt, who's one of the best American stand-ups, came out here and did. I think it might have been advertised, but it was in tiny letters and there was no poster for it. And he was here for like two nights. And
oh, no, this is different. This is just, it's not even on the official program.
Right.
But there are people who, if they were on the program, would sell out the town hall.
Okay, so we're
but
talking.
They're not in the town hall. They're not on the program, and you just have to know that they're here, that they're doing quiet shows, and you just have to be switched on.
Right.
And
I don't want to give anything away, but would the person's name contain any of these words: Wilson, Bloody, or Kevin? No.
Look, I just can't tell you anything in confidence, can I? No, they don't.
Okay, it's not him. All right.
No.
Oh, well, how do you know so much about what's? I wouldn't think of you as Mr. Comedy, John, but you're connected.
Finger on the pulse,
right?
Finger on the pulse. You get the whisper, and then you go and ruin it and spoil it for everybody by blurting it out on the radio.
I love a secret gig.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Davies, who's how's the way I'm segueing into the plug for my show?
You just ruined it by pointing out you were doing it.
I'm sorry, but
Let's try that again.
Okay, Alan Davies, who coincidentally I'm interviewing on A Quiet Word with this Saturday night on ABC One at 9:30. He used to come out here to Australia, and because all his relatives live out here. And in the early 90s, you would just hear, this bloke's going to be doing this gig at the Prince Pat at 1:30 on Thursday morning, and just get along there. And he was great. Do an hour.
You just had to be there.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a bit like when Bob Dylan was here, or, I don't know, Mick Jagger, and they got up on the stage at the Corner Hotel or whatever it might be, and you're like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a kind of a bit of a thrill, as well as the sort of hair standing up on the back of your neck. Yeah,
I
feeling.
The Corner Hotel, I remember, you know, the big crowded house at the Sydney Opera House, final gig. The night before that, they did a secret gig at the Corner Hotel, and it was probably much more interesting than the, well, it was a great one at the Sydney Opera House, but they were just doing, you know, tracks you've never
doing
heard.
Their stuff.
Yeah.
So you're on TV interviewing Alan Davies, who many of us know from his appearances with Stephen Fry on QI.
That's right.
And he's in lots of other things, including hosting a new, he's the main character in a new TV comedy.
Yes, he's in a show on the ABC, I think on Thursday nights, called Whites, which is
he's a cook.
Yeah, it's written by Matt King, in fact, or co-written by Matt King,
who was
a comedian based here in Melbourne through most of the 90s, and who plays Super Hans in Peep Show. And he was, of course, Jonathan Creek. He lived in a windmill wearing a duffel coat for many years, a magician's assistant that solves crimes, if you recall.
So you, how did you interview him? Was he in Melbourne?
No, we went to, because the idea with this show is that I'm just interviewing people who I'm a fan of, rather than...
Well, we're just indulging Tony Martin, are we?
Well, no, it's that thing.
We being the ABC.
Well, I used to do a radio, and as you know, when you do a radio show every day and there's guests coming through, there's some people who you're a big fan of, then there's some people who you indifferent about, and then there's some people who you've never heard of, but you've just been given a press release the night before.
Right.
And it's the ones who you're a big fan of that are the most fun to do. So the idea with this show was just to do ones with people I'm really into, so I don't have to pretend to like them.
Mel Brooks?
Well, Mel Brooks wasn't in town. Well, that's the thing. So many people, I don't know if you've noticed, but so few people, unless there's a comedy festival, obviously, come over here. Now, there's not Rove for people to go on. So in this instance, we went to England for, we're only there shooting for 3 days, and we got five episodes. So we've got Ross Noble, Rob Brydon, Catherine Tate, Richard E. Grant, and Alan Davies. And we shot all of those in London.
In how many days?
In 3 days. Yeah.
Go through again.
Richard E. Grant, Alan Davies.
Richard E. Grant, tall.
With Neil and I.
Yeah, yeah.
Catherine Tate from The Catherine Tate Show. Ross Noble, normally based here in Melbourne, but you may have heard his house burnt down in the bushfires. So
yeah, we interviewed him about it. Yes.
Back in England.
So you went over there to interview him?
Yeah, I did.
That's weird, but go on.
That is weird. Well, it's a matter of who you can get. If you're only there for 3 days,
bang, bang, bang.
It's Rubik's Cube time.
Yeah.
And Rob Brydon, who I guess not everyone would know. He's in Gavin and Stacey. He's Uncle Bryn.
Pass.
In that, and Alan Davies, the first one.
Five in how many days?
In 3 days.
Four.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not bad. Tony Martin from Northcote thinks he's pretty funny too.
Oh, is he a funny Tony Martin?
He says Tony Martin in Northcote's pretty funny, signed Tony Martin from Northcote.
Is he on Twitter as Northcote Tony Martin?
Oh, I don't know, but there you go. I can give you his number if you want to kind of get together and have a bonding session. So Alan Davies is Stephen Fry's, well,
fool guy, really, isn't he?
I was going to say his flirt boy.
Oh, okay.
Stephen Fry flirts outrageously with Alan.
Well, it's great because that show, I mean, it's been on for 8 years, QI.
But don't you think he flirts with him?
I hadn't thought of it in that way, but I guess so. I mean, it's an interesting combination. I would never have picked those two to become a kind of comedy team, which is what they've become. And on the show on Saturday night, Alan tells the whole story of how that show came about. It was originally meant to be hosted by Michael Palin. And, yeah, it's quite interesting. Listen to that. I've said it's quite interesting. Dear, oh dear. The horns should now go off and I should be banished.
It's not. It's incredibly, fantastically interesting. You just can't afford to miss it.
No. Yeah, but I haven't seen. Tell you what I like about.
Crank it up, Martin. We'll get the other Tony Martin from Northcote if you're not better than this.
Here's what I like about QI, because it's over 8 years, they just jump back and forward. Have you noticed that? You'll get one from 2007, and Stephen Fry, the weight fluctuates. You can tell what series you're in by what size Stephen
and what
Fry
he's wearing
is.
And the hair.
Yeah.
And the glasses change.
That's right.
It's a bit like Top Gear, isn't it? It's all over the place.
No, I haven't seen that Top Gear. I don't know anything about cars.
You don't have to. Top Gear's not, well, it used to not be about cars. It used to be about far more than cars, and it's more and more about cars now, which is why I suspect people aren't as happy with it as they used to be.
I just don't understand people's obsession with cars. You're inside the car. Who cares what it looks like, really?
No. Look, I'll give you my very best explanation of what Top Gear's about. Was a very early episode, and Clarkson was in the back of a taxi going from the airport in Tokyo into his hotel, and he filmed, just got off the plane, and he just filmed a monologue about the difference between an English taxi, a London taxi that he would have taken to the airport at that end compared to the Japanese taxi he's in going from the airport at the Japan end, and his observations of what you can learn about Japanese culture, Japanese life and Japanese society just from the taxi.
Right.
From the way the taxi is kitted out, the fact that there's little lace doilies everywhere.
Right, right. Gotcha.
The etiquette with the driver, the notices, the signs, the fee structure, the fact that there's a tissue box, all of these things, and the way he manages to draw on what is in the back seat of a taxi.
Yeah.
Not what's outside as you're going through, just what's there to talk about the difference between England and Japan and its society and its culture and its history. That's good stuff. Top Gear used to be about. Now it's about.
Right. Well, I'm reading. I tell you what, I've got at home. I'm reading Clive James's latest, The Blaze of Obscurity. And you're reading it and you forget. Remember Clive James just on TV all the time?
Yeah.
He was like for 20 years. Yeah. It was. But what's happened to him? He's gone reclusive.
Well, he's getting on a bit. Right. He was here a few years ago for one of the festivals and he was on the Convo Hour for an hour and he was just mesmerised.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've been told to say conversation hour.
Every week he would just be on TV going, saying things like, what on earth would make Kylie Minogue choose to do a duet with Margarita Prakatan? Remember Margarita Prakatan? There's a name from the 90s I hadn't heard for a very long time. What's happened to her? Why isn't she on the conversation hour?
Precisely. What can I say?
Tony Martin is my co-host, our first guest in a moment, comedian Mark Watson, one of the 50 funniest people in Britain, according to the London Times. He's our first guest. Then there's live music with Celtic Thunder, the Celtic boy band. Well, they're not really boys anymore. That's coming up on The Conversation Hour.
774 ABC Melbourne.
We're joined by Mark Watson, who is here for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Morning to you, Mark.
Hi there, John.
Now, your performances are not part of the secret...
They're secret, but I am publicising the date and time and venue. So sort of it's a fairly open secret.
What is the secret comedy festival program? I mean, this is very clever marketing, isn't it?
Yeah,
non-marketing marketing. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I didn't know about this until, I have to say, the more we talk about these secret shows, the less secret they feel. Except that we still don't know who we're talking about, except we know it's not Kevin Bloody Wilson, which is disappointing news.
Don't you wish you were part of the secret comedy festival program?
Well, I kind of don't, because the only thing with secret shows is people don't tend to attend them, because they don't know where to find them.
Really so secret.
Yeah, I've gone with the sort of, perhaps, slightly less bold marketing plan of telling people what I'm doing this year.
More conventional. Part.
Yeah, I did one of my best shows was a secret season in 2002, but not one person ever saw it. It was just me in my bedroom. So I've kind of broadened my demographic since then.
You were a recluse for a year. What happened?
That's right. Yeah, I did. It's funny. This is one of the sort of less well-known facts about me. On my website, it says that I disappeared in 2003, and it's, to be honest, not true. It's just that when you're writing a bio, it's quite boring, and it says, in 2004, you did this radio show, TV show. So just for fun, really, I put on my website, in 2003, he disappeared, and the mystery's never been cleared up, which I thought was fairly obviously a joke. But then I was nearly turned down for a mortgage recently at home because some mortgage advisor looked at it and said, well, what if he was to disappear again? I had to write a letter saying, just to clarify, I am a comedian and not every claim I make about myself is true.
That's good. It's good to start a lie, though, and have it and just see how far it goes.
It was incredible to see it
comes back to you.
Pick up, exactly, because now in interviews, sometimes people do ask me in all earnestness, so what about this year that you disappeared then? Yeah.
Well, I spoke to Catherine Tate for one of these shows, and she said
name dropper.
I know it is a name drop, but this is a good one. She goes, in every interview, they go, so where do you get your characters from? How do you think your characters?
Yeah.
And she said for a joke, she went, I get them from this shop on the high street. That sells...
Which, again, you think is a pretty obvious joke.
Yeah. Off the peg. And she, to this day, 5 years on. So where is this shop where you obtain your characters?
Amazing stuff. If it was possible to get characters in a high street like that, I think there'd be more people like Catherine Tate around. I know a guy, a comedian at home, who's been doing it for about 20, 30 years, and every time someone asks him, how do you get into comedy, which is a sort of dreaded question, and he claims it used to be a TV repairman. And if he wasn't able to fix people's TVs, he would just stand there and talk as if he was the TV. And that's how he started to become a comedian. And again, I've seen that clearly a joke, but I've seen it reproduced in interviews.
Oh,
he began being a comedian when he wasn't able to fix a television and had to substitute for a couple. Incredible. People will pretty much buy anything, especially with the internet. These things go around.
So, Mark Watson, how did you get into comedy?
Oh, hang on. Steady.
It's a funny story, actually. I used to sell fish and chips. the trouble is, the reason people dread the question is it's normally a really boring answer. Yeah, like for me, I just started doing open mics, and then you work your way up.
I'm actually not that interested.
Exactly, you shouldn't be. It's really boring.
I just
boring.
Thought I'd throw it out there to make people laugh.
Yeah, but no, the answer I give is that I...
it's really boring. Yeah.
I saved someone's life once, and they said, you should become a comedian.
You say you don't do secret gigs, but what you do tend to do is just insanely long ones. You'll hear every festival, it's like, how long is he going to do this time?
Yeah, I have done these 20... I've done a 24-hour show, and I did do a 36-hour show. The first time I did it in Melbourne, it was close to being a secret gig because it wasn't very well publicised, and I had to sort of spread the word. But if a show goes for 24 hours, there's a good chance it'll spread as it goes on. In fact, that's probably the closest I've come to doing something genuinely. That was a bit like a flash mob, actually. It started with about 12 people, and then it was in Federation Square, and it ended with about 400 people, but it didn't really matter how many people there were because I was too tired. I might have been seeing double, to be fair. It could have been 200.
But the new technology lends itself to this stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does, yeah.
You know, you can be somewhere and tell however many people you've got in your phone, hey, come here, this is really good, and then they arrive.
Yeah, I've done things like on Twitter and things like that where I've done shows entirely publicised like that. But that would be more at home in a kind of ad hoc situation where there's maybe 50 people. If it's an entire comedy festival, I wouldn't tend to hinge everything on technology.
But see,
like
the compounding impact, I mean, we should work around with this
Tony, if you've got 10 people and they all send a message to everyone their phone, and if only 10% of them turn up, you know, you've got hundreds of people in your phone, and on it goes. In no time at all, you can have a massive number of people who are somewhere for no apparent reason except that they've been told,
yes,
let's see how big a crowd we can get.
Well, getting a stunker, I know Ross Noble did something on in one of his shows where there was, you know, 10,000 people in the audience, and he staged some sort of pointless event on stage. He pushed an owl off a chair.
That's right,
and he got everyone to film it on their phones, and then the idea was to get everyone to upload it to YouTube at the same time and try and get the most amount of clips of exactly the same pointless act happening from a slightly different angle.
Yeah, the most publicised pushing of an owl ever seen. I think the more powerful and the quicker technology becomes, the because at the moment, if you try and do something like that, often people can't get signal because they're all getting in each other's way and stuff like that. But in 5 years, I imagine everything will be totally wireless and instant. And then goodness knows what comedians will be able to do to the internet.
There'll be owl pushers like you've never seen before.
There'll be owl pushers. There'll be wild claims about character shops left, right and centre.
And wasn't someone trying to organise a concert using mobile phone ringtones and button, you know, everyone pushed 974 at the same time, or 774, I suppose I should come up with. And, you know, they go beep, beep, boop, beep, beep, boop. And
that's probably the most horrendous thought I can imagine.
Thousands of people's phones making identical tones at the same time.
No, I'd much rather listen to Celtic Thunder than that. I think we all would.
Well, what Celtic Thunder should do is, what did the Flaming Lips do? Did they do something where people had car stereos on at the same time?
Something like that. The Flaming Lips done all kinds of stuff like that.
Events.
I mean, what was it? Something like everyone played the same song on the car stereo at the same
something
time.
Something like that. Or they had different instruments or something. They all had to be synced up.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I mean, obviously a lot of planning involved for a...
Yeah, that's the song. Thing. Quite often these spontaneous gestures actually take about a team of seven people working around the clock for a year. Yeah. You can sometimes differentiate between a genuine spontaneous prank and one which has actually taken... As a general rule, if there's a press release sent to you beforehand, then it's not as spontaneous.
It's a bit like what the photographer Spencer Tunick does when he comes to town and, you know, arranges for thousands of people to suddenly assemble and strip naked in a particular place, takes their photo, everyone gets dressed and walks off again.
That's right. Again, that's the sort of thing you do need to pre-plan that. If you just walk into Federation Square and say, right, all get naked, I've got a camera, you'll find it doesn't go as well.
But generally, if your name's Spencer Tunick...
Well,
and you say it's art.
That's the thing.
People will suddenly do what they're
told. You
do
need to have a reputation for you. If Tony or I just went with a camera.
You've obviously got a Spencer Tunick is a good name too.
It's a superb name, yeah. Even if I'm naked, at least this man's name suggests that there'll be clothes not too far away.
So
I've got a very poor record of people taking their clothes off when I ask them just for a photo,
really?
Actually. Yeah, I nearly always... To get hundreds of people to do it at once is well beyond me. Even two people is hard enough. Yeah.
Two at the same time.
It really is, yeah. I've tried it, yeah. Even in Melbourne, which is a very friendly place, it's surprisingly hard to get completely strangers to go naked. But as you say, under the umbrella of art, suddenly it's fine, yeah.
Or obviously if you had, you know, Katie Lang tickets or some carrot you could dangle, you know, that's what you need. Giveaways.
You are shameless.
Fun to love.
From commercial
all
radio.
He's saying is, what, we
are
you do have a couple of Katie Lang.
Are you suggesting we should give away Katie Lang tickets to the next person who appears naked at the ABC studios?
Yes, and I'm suggesting that as well. And I'll chuck in a couple of tickets to my show.
See, John, what you don't understand is, in the world of commercial
radio...
Can I
just say that is not the competition?
it might be, though. There's two of us.
I'm sure there are at least two or three stations doing that right now on the FM band.
Yeah, or it doesn't have to be under the ABC umbrella. I'll just unofficially give two tickets to anyone that I meet naked outside.
There you go.
So if someone comes to one of your gigs naked, they don't need a ticket, you'll let them in.
I better not set a precedent because the forum management might not thank me. But if I come out in half an hour out of the South Bank and someone turns up naked, I'll probably arrange for them to get two tickets.
You've got to be careful what you say because you...
I don't want to be responsible for this.
Oh, you're not. This is absolutely my responsibility.
You will be doing a show that looks like a Spencer Tunick photograph.
Oh, I should say, when they come to the show, I'll expect them to be fully clothed like everyone else. Otherwise, it would be too much of a talking point.
Yes.
They'll overshadow the action.
Don't want to peek too early.
Not really, no. Be a good thing to be able to talk about for 5 minutes, but then you'd be aware that whatever you said, people were glancing back at the naked people. Yeah.
Hey, you write novels.
I blame you for this, Tony.
I'm doing a gear change. Listen to that.
I blame you. This is not the way the conversation now usually goes.
Doesn't it?
I blame
you. Enough comedians on. You shouldn't have the comedians on.
I've lowered the tone. Novels. How long does it take you to write one?
Tony, that was a seamless gear change.
It was. It's brilliant.
I thought it was a very good sort of upward shift in terms of the tone as well.
Nudity to literature.
Yeah, novels are much more the ABC kind
of
crowd.
About the length of the year 2002?
That's right. Yeah, in my secret year, I wrote four novels that no one's ever seen yet. It takes probably about. I wrote most of the last novel in Melbourne actually. While I was here for kind of about. It only takes about maybe 3 to 6 months or something. But then editing is another. Mm. So it probably takes longer to actually edit the book and make it good.
3 to 6 months, Mark, is a 100% variation.
Yes, 3 to 6 to 12 to 24 months. Yeah,
I like you. You did one called Bullet Points. I enjoyed that.
First one. Yeah.
What's the new one called?
This one's called 11, and it came out here like last. I was going to say autumn, but because of your peculiar seasonal, it was probably spring here.
Right.
Anyway, about 2 seasons ago, it came out. It's about a Melbournean living in London, actually, a radio announcer as well.
Oh, really?
It is, yeah. Almost too good to be true. It's about a bloke from Melbourne who is on the radio and he sort of starts his life again in London because of some events which gradually sort of unfold during the... that took, about, let's say, 3 months because that's, as you say, that's a more concrete answer. But then... Yeah, the process of editing it and making it good is a lot longer than... It's not that hard to just dash out a novel, but it is hard to go back and think, oh, that doesn't make any sense.
Do you have a good editor?
Yeah, I've got an excellent editor, which unfortunately sometimes means that she'll say that this is rubbish, yeah.
It's got to go.
Yeah, she's harsh but fair.
It's good, though, because I had a good editor, and it's like the phrase I remember using is it's saving you from yourself.
Exactly, yeah, especially if you're a comedian. Your natural tendency is to just, you know, go off on all sorts of tangents.
That's my best joke.
There.
You exactly. can't lose that. That's the best bit.
Yeah, and the book isn't even really a comedy. You know, this novel is quite sort of dark, so I needed her to just slash all the all the funny bits out. But she's a very sensitive. She's a really good editor, yeah. You don't want an editor who's too heavy-handed, but you do want an editor that's got the courage to just say, you should take that. It's a bit like having your essay back at school. You'll get it back and there's pen all over it, and your first instinct is just fury because a whole paragraph will be crossed out and it'll say, we don't need this. And then months later you think, yeah, she was right, actually. Yeah.
Have you snuck any good words in that you've always wanted to use? Because I heard a word on the weekend, and people probably know this word, lachrymose.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
It means crying, that given to tears, doesn't it?
Like, I've got to get that in somewhere. It's fun just to say.
I think it means teary, basically. Okay. Over-emotional. Lachrymose is a great word.
You can sneak one in.
I'll stick that in the next one.
What have you got? What words have you got in your new novel?
I don't want to give too much away, but there could be an attenuation in there.
Oh, very nice.
So it doesn't get better.
We're slightly distracted by the fact that
it just doesn't get better.
There's a load of singers here now.
That's right. Yeah, we are being intimidated by a group of men.
Celtic Thunder, who are coming in. They're about to perform live a cappella for us here in the studio. But Mark Watson, his show is in the program. It's official. It's public. It's declared. It exists. He's
absolutely
real.
Absolutely happening.
What's it called?
It's actually just called Mark Watson.
Called Mark Watson. You've gone like the band that does the 11th self-titled
like
album.
Like Portishead or something. Yes. Yeah. I was in Britain, the same show was called Do I Know You? Because it's about kind of like questions of identity and blah, blah, blah. But I thought in Australia, people might think, no, I don't think I do know you. It seemed like too much of a gamble to call it that. Yeah.
George Donaldson and Keith Harkin are the two representatives of Celtic Thunder, who are not just singing but talking to us as well. And thank you very much. It was a beautiful performance before. How did you go from being a builder to a singer, George?
I got the bus, basically, down to... No, I used to be a coach builder in my day life and for 20 years working in a factory. And
a coach builder?
Yeah, I'm building buses, obviously.
Not hand-building wooden cars?
No.
Or carriages?
That was a sideline hobby, but... I went for an audition for this show, and that's how I got involved in it. I mean, apart from doing the building buses at home, I would be a folk singer in Scotland as well. So travelled around doing that, and I wanted to go and meet the great Phil Coulter, who's the musical director of the show, and he was holding the auditions. And I'd jokingly often enough say they were looking for a 6'2" Scottish man with loads of hair. So they got some of that.
You better explain, it's radio.
He's absolutely bald.
Yeah, I didn't say absolutely. I just shaved the rest.
Substantially.
Hang on, he's 6'2", just be careful. He's big, your skin.
And he's Scottish as well. Yeah.
Do you have a webcam? Are we on the internet?
Yeah, we do.
People can confirm that.
Yeah, but we don't need him to stand up to see that he's 6'2". And Keith, you're that odd thing.
Right.
An Irish surfer.
What's odd about that?
Well... We don't really think of Ireland as the surfing capital of the world.
Well, yeah, Ireland's got probably the same surf as you do here, really. It's just a lot colder, believe it or not.
A lot colder,
yeah. Yeah, someone was chatting to me, like, I think it's cold as get here. It was a guy was saying to me the other night, he's like, it was 14 degrees. and I was like 14 degrees, like as warm as it gets with us is 17 if we're lucky in the summer. Yeah. So you're constantly wearing, like in the winter, I was surfing about 2 months ago in Ireland, it was minus 20 degrees Celsius outside.
And what do you
wear?
Say
surfing? Was it ice, in fact?
Yeah, it was ice surfing.
Actually, nah. Skating.
Yeah, yeah. No, you wear 6mm boots, 6mm gloves. The only piece of skin you can see is just the round piece of your face.
So you look like a penguin or a seal.
You look like a seal. The shark's delight.
Is there any Irish surfing terminology you could give us? Any catchphrases?
Yeah, it's freezing.
Right.
Yeah, let's go home.
What am I doing out here?
Because most people I know that surf just cannot get the word stoked into their conversation.
Certain words like that just don't sound good with our accent, like gnarly man.
No.
Or dude.
Yeah.
I just feel like a twat when I say it.
Stoked dude.
It's just so pumping, man.
This is all over my bald head here. I don't know.
But then he probably doesn't know much about building buses, as just like you don't know much about surfing.
Possibly.
Believe it or not, I just finished building my own camper van about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah?
Yep, completely finished. Hot and cold running water, shower, cooker, oven, sink, 2 double beds and a TV.
Is this true?
Aye, it is.
What is it with you people in building vehicles?
I don't know.
I never build vehicles.
I bought an old school bus and then I bought a caravan because it was too expensive to buy all the pieces for the tour, but they build me bus. And I ripped all the insides out of a caravan and refitted everything inside a school bus.
Where are you going to go?
I'm on tour now in Ireland for a month, so I'm using it as a tour bus.
Oh, God. So it's like a star car.
If you could call it that, yeah.
Notice how it's got 2 double beds. That's because he's a pop star.
Mm, yeah, right. 2 is barely enough.
It's actually double bunk beds, believe it or not.
Yeah. So, really? Oh, the sexiest bed of them all.
One of them's full of beer.
John said at the beginning that there's groupies. So there actually is, isn't there?
I've got I have some information, yes. Do they travel everywhere with you?
The groupies?
Yeah, a bit less here at the moment because we're still trying to establish ourselves in Australia. But in America, you know, you tend to, there's a lot of groupies hanging around. But
in that bus.
Yeah, me being the only married guy, I don't get the chance to mention anything like that.
No, just
you
get
can
to
mention it.
No, I can't. My wife listens sometimes.
Well, she heard that anyway.
That wasn't me.
It's not like your voice stands out at all.
That wasn't me, right?
That wasn't me, hen.
Well, it must be hard being married and on tour all the time.
That's probably one of the easier aspects of it. You get a chance to... kidding aside, now, yeah, as I've got a 10-year-old daughter, and I find that really hard to be away from. The funny thing is, we're leaving here today. I think at 5 o'clock is my flight, and I'm going back up to Sydney, and my wife and my daughter will be up there waiting on me. So I've not seen them for about 4 weeks. So that's a good thing. It's hard being away, I think, yeah, but you sort of get used to it and you just sort of adapt to it. You don't want to be away for any 3 or 4 months at a time sort of pining to get home. You have to just sort of give up on it and get in the groove and, you know, just stay on target kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's probably a better way to make a living than building buses.
Yeah. I hate when I get interviewed and anything like that because it reminds me of what I used to do.
Yeah.
You're scratching the old wounds and the old nightmares there.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think lots of people reinvent themselves. Tony Martin used to be a butcher.
Yes, that's very true. But,
used to butcher jokes. Yes, yeah.
Well, still butchering jokes. But one thing I love about bands on tour is you've got to have rivals. Have you got enemies, a nemesis? You know, Blur.
They're all within the group, yeah.
But what, like a Blur Oasis? Is there another Thunder?
Is there another Celtic group?
Celtic from down under?
That you're sort of trying to avoid? Stones, Beatles style?
I wouldn't say that, no. We don't want to. No rivalry. We wish them all luck.
We love everyone.
Oh, really?
I thought from your song that you were real bad boys.
Nah. Yeah. I actually was I'd done a thing in Philadelphia a few weeks ago, and the guy hadn't got a clue what I was. It was like a live show, and it was on radio. And I listened back to the live recording. I'd done like 5 songs. But before I went on, the guy was all, yeah, I think I know these guys. They're like a death metal band from Ireland.
I was like, no, we're not.
The guy hadn't got a clue what we were like.
Similar style, isn't it?
It's but close enough, yeah. Really, just a lot.
I was waiting for the death metal bit to kick
in. Yeah, I do a lot of. I actually do a lot of shredding on the stage, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, where did the assembly of the group come from? Was someone responsible for putting it all together?
Yeah, well, Phil Coulter, the producer of this, he does the music, and then Sharon Brown, our director. Sharon she was the one who sort of invented Celtic Woman as well. If you ever heard of that group, and they were sort of really successful in America, and they're actually in Australia also. And they held auditions all around Ireland and Scotland. That's where they found George Boy. And we all auditioned. Actually, I was in a bar having a beer with my dad. And
as you would in Ireland.
As you do. And yeah. I was only home from London, and I was having a beer with my dad, and my dad was reading the paper. And he seen this audition in the paper, and he told me to go, and I had no interest in going. I had no money to go. So my dad paid for my cab to go to the audition, and I got my guitar. And they let me through, and here I am 4 years later.
It's a bit like those television competition shows, maybe.
Yeah, they specify that it's definitely not something like that. It wasn't narrowing down. It was to come for an audition. If we like you, we're picking you, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's a real job application.
Yeah.
It was like 11 weeks, and you had to cry.
No, it was an audition, just, you know.
I don't know why people go on those shows, because they're so obviously exploitative.
Yeah.
When we are less obviously exploitative.
I can understand. I can understand too, though. I mean, I've seen people on the shows that I know, and they've been trying for a long, long time.
It just feels like your last chance.
And they're really good. And, and you can't blame people either when someone knows they're good and they have no other sort of scapegoat, they do it.
It must be frustrating if you're like a really good pub singer for years and then everyone's saying to you, have you heard of this thing, The X Factor?
Yeah.
Eventually, that'll be my break.
A number of times I heard that when I was a really good pub singer.
Exactly.
Now I'm just a really average stage singer these
days. On the contrary.
But didn't sound like it.
But Comedy Try It
Night. I was kidding there, incidentally.
That must be similar things. Yeah. A Comedy Try It Night's the same? It's a genuine opportunity or just cheap entertainment for the crowd and the pub doesn't have to pay?
Well, I got into stand-up comedy at a good time because in Melbourne there used to be, down at the Gershwin Room, they had a thing called the Delivery Room where they had this, people remember this in Melbourne, a filthy, oil-covered, matted piece of rope that hung from the ceiling on the stage, and acts were not allowed to do any material they'd done before. It was called Rope Night, and if somebody did a bit of old material, the audience would shout out rope, and the comedian, it was very humiliating, would have to go and hold the rope while they did the rest of their act.
There's something like this in London as well. Yeah.
So what it did, it was like all the great comedians in Melbourne had lost their superpowers for a night. So it was good. It was a good opportunity for tryouts to come in and be on the same bill as people flailing about.
But it's got that ritual humiliation.
Yeah,
to it, hasn't
there's
it?
More what? Ritual humiliation in comedy than there is in Celtic singing. It's not quite. So it's not a case of come and if we like you, we'll pick you. It's more a case of if we hate you, we'll chuck stuff at you, and you'll have to hold a greasy bit of rope.
That's right. Has anyone ever thrown anything at you?
Yeah, once I did a gig in when I was very young and like 23, but very inexperienced, and I got coins thrown at me. I tried to make a joke of it, saying, this is more than I'm getting paid for the actual gig. You know, this was true, but that just made them stop throwing coins and start throwing other stuff. So,
but Celtic Thunder would never be accused of doing old material. You know, we've heard that one before.
Yeah, that's the thing with being songwriters. People aren't going to shout out, we've heard this, probably. If anything, people probably
it's like a joke. It's not the joke, it's how you tell it.
That's the thing, yeah. You probably know? Got classic songs that people...
Some people could, read a joke, and it wouldn't be funny at all, and a different person could read exactly the same joke and you'd be on the
floor. But people want you to do Danny Boy and they want you to do all those things.
Yeah, forever ask for their songs, I mean, but I don't know. When you're a singer, you have to make every time appeal like it's the first time you've done it, because you're getting a brand new audience every time. It's not any fault of theirs to not be at the first show or the second or the third. If you have 50 shows down the line, it's got to be pristine.
It's the same with the comedians as well. You've got to make out that you're still excited about what you're saying, even if you're thinking, oh, I know. You feel like you've done it so many times. These people must know how this joke ends. Surely. Everyone knows.
I know, but see, what do you mean make out like?
I know, but when you do a show, if you get people in the audience, the same folk. I mean, for a song, people come to hear a song. Do people come to hear a joke, the same joke, five times?
Well,
I don't mean that in any bad way, but how does it feel?
Absolutely fine, yeah. Sometimes if I'm having a bad gig, I'll do the same joke five times within the show,
But do you remember, there's a show called Phoenix Nights, a British sitcom, and it's Peter set in a sort of a leagues club, as it were, and there's a scene where an alternative comedian comes to town and nobody gets any of his material, and the Brian Potter character yells out, tell us a joke we know!
There is an element of that, What you normally find is that it's difficult because most of your audience obviously want to hear new stuff and they want to hear stuff, they want you to improvise and just play with the audience. But there'll be the occasional fan that is like, you didn't do that joke about the pigeon. You already know it. You can do it for yourself by the sound of it. Yeah. They say, I'll tell you what I like. That bit where you talk about adverts and then you do this, and they basically describe the exact same joke to you. Well, you don't really need me to do this. I think you have it in your brain already.
It's like, not they drop it on, but one time we played in the White House. Imagine that, about 2 years ago on St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, for President Obama and stuff. And it was amazing. Yeah. Great day.
I think that's worth dropping in.
Yeah. But no, that day...
I thought Tony Martin was name-dropping.
Yeah.
But I think
Catherine Tate is beaten by Obama.
But no, the same thing that day. We went to a bar that night and we were still dressed in the kilts from the show. And there was a guy singing. And eventually I asked him, I was like, can I sing a song? And the bar was packed, St. Patrick's Day in Washington. Like, you may guess what it was like. But I ended up to do a song, and it wasn't an Irish song. Like, I just went up and sung a song, and the whole bar kind of stopped. Yeah. And in the middle of the crowd, there's this one dude going, "Sing something Irish, you douchebag." Come on.
Where's Danny Boy?
He's standing in a kilt at home after in the White House.
So what did you sing?
A song, Mary Claire, by Peter Starstead. Where do you go to, my lovely?
Where do you go to, my lovely? Yeah.
What else would I sing?
Yeah, where do you go to, my lovely? Is it Cork?
Make it clear, you sung the first verse maybe a dozen times. Yeah, so there was another repeat.
It was funny, like, because, like, yeah, we were like sort of the smoking area, because it was the only place we could stand, and the PA was in the smoking area, and the other part of the bar was like where you sung, was my, like, a big bar. And the guy says they were just all standing, though the music stops, and this PA system just starts blasting out Mary Claire. It was the same verse like six times, so I was so drunk.
Amazing stuff. It's not every day you can go to the White House and get called a douchebag in the same day. That's ups
unless
and downs.
You're President Bush.
Yeah,
well, true.
Yeah, for some people it's daily occurrence, yeah.
And is President Obama a fan of Celtic music? What did he have to say?
Surprisingly enough, his wife, Michelle, and his two daughters, Tasha and Sasha, they were all there for the sound check, and I was pretty nervous, to be honest. I think we all were. We were all standing in the...
That's a big gig, yeah.
...presidential room. Yeah. Nobody meet him and stuff like that. And his wife, we met him, and he was like A1, and his wife came out, and she was like, Celtic Thunder. She was a fan of the show.
Oh, that's amazing.
Which is awesome. Like,
that is pretty amazing.
And how was the president?
He was great.
Yeah, as we were saying, you know you're in the presence of a great man. When he walked into the room, you could feel that this guy was in his position because of what he is, who he is, and what he's capable of.
Just that pushing that button on the desk.
See, everyone seems to think I didn't see that button there.
Like maybe they changed the desk.
I didn't
let you go and sit behind
the
desk.
They
probably tape it down when they've got a band in, just in case. Yeah. Me and Tony are struggling a bit here. Have you performed to any world leaders, Tony?
No, I don't think I have. I don't think I have. I saw Robert Muldoon, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, waddling down a corridor once.
I saw Berlusconi on TV.
Oh, Berlusconi. What's he doing? There's just been flashing up headlines that Berlusconi is flying people from a refugee island to, and I'm going, not to one of his bunga bunga parties.
I'd be suspicious of boarding any plane that he chartered, I think.
No, they had 8,000 African refugees arrive in one day at Lampedusa, and there's 20,000 people now currently on the islands, and Malta and Sicily are being overrun with African refugees. So,
right,
yeah, they're not sure what to do. People trying to get away from Libya and from Tunisia and...
Well, that's
elsewhere.
Terrible. But what is a bunga bunga party, John? I mean,
I think we should ask someone who has two double beds in their camper.
Okay, fair enough.
Bonga bonga. Well, let me explain this one.
That's the spirit.
I'm looking forward to this, Keith.
But you know, you see it in the paper. Whenever there's an article about Berlusconi, they say the woman was invited to one of his notorious bunga bunga parties.
People start using the phrase as if we all were meant to know what this is. Yeah. Sometimes it's not even in inverted commas.
No,
it's
just like the people who's going to turn up naked outside the radio station today will be able to tell us what bunga bunga party is.
Yeah, but let's just clarify, they will not win tickets to KD Lang by doing that.
I'm glad you brought that up again. There's been a couple of cryptic messages on the text messaging screen about that, and I'm not going to read them out, but thank you. You've provided me with a little bit of a smile along the way. Keith Harkin and George Donaldson are but two of the guys from Celtic Thunder, and you're touring around. You say you're back to Sydney?
I'm going back to Sydney to meet the family. The rest of the guys, I think, are going home. I think Ryan, one of the other chaps, is maybe going to stay behind for another week. But as I say, we're here doing the promotion for what we're hoping to achieve next year. Yep. And hopefully there'll be a tour maybe February.
Well, that'd be great. And Keith, surely you're going to have a surf.
Yep, I would love to. Yeah, the guys were in New Zealand for 4 days at the start of last week. I got here on Tuesday last week and I flew to the Goldie. And I've surfed the Goldie for a few days and I surfed Lennox Head and Byron Bay and I surfed Ballina. And in 2 days, I was out Thursday, I saw a shark. And I was out Friday, and a great white jumped about 10 feet in front of me.
Yeah, they do that all the time. For
no big deal.
That's like a gap year in 1 week.
Yeah. My friend was here, he's here 5 years, my buddy from home, and he's been surfing here for 5 years, and he said he hasn't seen one. And 2 days I was out, it's pretty scary the second day. Yeah.
Like, so you're going to surf while you're in Melbourne?
I leave now at 1 o'clock to fly back home there.
You've got to go down to Bells.
I wish I could. They work me too hard.
A bit late now.
Yeah.
Cancel your flight.
Oh, yeah.
Get a car, head down to Bells, have a surf, go tomorrow.
If only it was that easy. I actually have 7 American guys landing in my house on Friday. I'm touring Ireland for a month, in the double bed, double bunk bed bus. We're going to have
bunga
party.
You've got the bus out the front. You can just tell them the keys on the wheel well, and they can sort themselves.
You can't be late for your own bunga bunga party.
No. Very poor form. You can't throw a bunga bunga party and not have the whole.
No.
Keith Harkin and George Donaldson, just two of the members of Celtic Thunder. A new CD and a DVD out. They're coming to you fresh from performing for President Obama at the White House. That's not bad. That's not bad. That left Tony Martin short of words. Mark Watson. Mark Watson.
Whatever. Obama.
Here for a not secret, a very, very public season
at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Tony Martin, my co-host on The Conversation Hour today. Thank you all for joining us on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. This has been a very special Bunga Bunga Conversation Hour.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available every day. Log on to abc.net.au/Melbourne, click the podcast link and subscribe now. You'll never know who you'll end up with on your player. abc.net.au/Melbourne.